This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Writer Drew McGarry imagined a world in which science discovered a cure for natural death. The book he wrote is called Postmortal, and it's Drew's first novel. Drew will tell you it took a lot of discipline and control to write that book. Fans of the websites Deadspin or Kissing Susie Kobler know a different side of Drew McGarry. On those sites, he writes about sports, but not in a Sports Illustrated kind of a way. His postings are full of vitriol and profanity, and they're hilarious. Drew's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock, then the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tomorrow night at 7 to talk about his book, The Postmortal. But first, we have him in the studio now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Tell us about The Postmortal. What's the theory? What's the principle behind it?
Basically, the idea of the book is that it's about what happens when a cure for aging is invented. And this is where your aging would be frozen at whatever point you wish. So, in other words, if you want to have your age frozen at 33, you can do that. People who are late to the cure, when it's discovered, if they're 50, they get it at 50. Your age freezes in place. You can't go back. So it's sort of – the idea was that in the beginning, this would be heralded as a miracle. This would be a wonderful thing. And then, of course, things get progressively worse and more horrible from there. So it's sort of a thought experiment turned into a novel.
What got you thinking about it?
I watched a 60-minute piece once on a drug called resveratrol. And it's the thing that's in red wine. And, you know, it's the idea that people, you know, if you have one glass of red wine a day, you get enough of this chemical where everything's very nice and you live a longer, healthier life. So they're trying to make a drug out of this. They're trying to concentrate this into a pill. And, you know, they were speculating, well, you know, maybe one day they'll prolong aging indefinitely. And wouldn't that be wonderful? And I thought, well, no, everything would go to hell. And so this was a sort of a I started thinking about specifically how exactly that would go about. And this novel represents sort of my best guess, which certainly obviously isn't.
And one of the problems that you take on in the book is, and you wouldn't think about this, but when you say, you know, in your marriage vows, till death do us part, that now takes on a whole new meaning. Maybe I can get you to read for us from the book, a section
sure.
of the book that kind of you know, talks a little bit about this.
Well, I had one other place marked, but we could talk about marriage right after that.
All right, let's talk about this reading first, and then and we will move on.
All right, this is a lot of the book is composed of there's sort of a personal blog, but then also sort of extrapolate articles and other things like that. So this is one of the phony articles in there. So four Procure demonstrators were shot dead today by National Guardsmen in the New Hampshire state capital of Concord, after a massive protest turned into the most violent cure-related conflict since two students were shot dead in a Berlin riot 3 weeks ago. After a widespread report released yesterday accusing the United States military of offering the so-called cure for death to its own soldiers in exchange for extended pension benefits, protesters here in the Granite State marched on the Capitol. Many were incensed. They were trying to force their way inside the building. They wanted to take it over, said lawyer Jim Watley, who works in the Capitol. I don't know what they would have done if they had gotten in, but that was their aim. A small group of National Guardsmen charged with protecting the Capitol tried to keep protesters at bay with shields and threats of tear gas. But witnesses say a crazed protester threw a lit Molotov cocktail at the guardsmen, which prompted two of them to open fire into the crowd, causing protesters to flee in mass panic. Four people are now confirmed dead. An unspecified number of people were injured, including Jackie Frost of Nashua, New Hampshire, who was shot in the leg. They were supposed to use rubber bullets, she cried. No one else was armed. Why didn't they use rubber bullets? The number of people killed in today's incident is the same as those killed in the 1970 shootings at the Kent State University in Kent, Ohio. Further details forthcoming.
Drew McGarry reading from The Postmortal, his novel. He'll be at Flyleaf Books tonight, Regulator Bookshop tomorrow, in the studio now. So what's the controversy? I mean, as you said, on the face of it, not a bad idea.
Yeah, in the beginning, a couple of countries make it illegal with the idea that they need to sort of gird themselves for the reality of overpopulation. They know that they're not going to have enough resources, enough food, enough water, enough oil, enough fuel. And at the outset, it's first banned until they can sort of figure out what's going on. But that doesn't sit well with people who believe that the government is taking too much control and letting them die. So the idea is that this prohibition causes a lot of mass resentment and eventually in violence and then sort of upheaval.
And a lot of blog posts play an important part in the novel, as you just read the blog post, and it also indicates that you can die. You can be shot to death. You can have cancer. You get hit by a car. You just can't die of old age.
That's right.
So that's part of it. And now all of the problems that both personal and social that you can start to imagine if you think it through begin to happen. Marriage, for instance.
We talked about
that a second ago.
Yeah, because with marriage, you know, when you get married now, you have this definitive idea of what your lifespan is going to be. You're going to have this young sort of married time together. You'll have children. The children will age. You'll go through middle age as your children grow. And once your children are grown, you'll go through retirement, or, you know, you'll have this sort of time to sit on a porch and sip lemonade for, you know, the 20 last years, and then you die together. But if it's extended out to 500 years or 1,000 years, that whole storyline of life goes out the window. There's no set period of, okay, this is when you have children, this is when you retire, this is when your children grow and you become a grandparent. All of that gets thrown into upheaval. And that sort of uncertainty, I think, would have a lot of burden for people. I think it would be very difficult for people to get married if they knew they were going to live for 1,000 years. And I think if they did, I think it would take a lot of commitment, obviously. Obviously, right now, you're pledging your whole life to someone else when you get married, which is still a lot. But I think the daunting nature of not quite knowing when the end is coming, not having that definitive idea of, okay, it'll probably be around age 70 or age 80 or something like that. The idea you don't know if you're going to live till you're 500 or you're 1500, that makes a big difference.
That's what walking down the aisle, I said to myself, okay, I'll marry you because someday, thank God, I'll be dead.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, though.
That's how that went.
You get married in a certain sense because you know you're going to die. You get married because you know you're going to grow old. You're not going to be virile. You're not going to be able to prowl around clubs when you're 52. That's not going to make any sense.
It's a form of immortality.
Yeah. You want sort of a stability. You want to know there's someone who's going to be there when you, frankly, are not as desirable as you once were.
And you are a blogger. We talked about Deadspin and Kissing Susie Kobler, two blogs that you write for regularly. Did that help you or hinder you being a blogger? It's a much smaller form that you write in as a blogger.
It is. It's good because I think it's good training ground for novelists and stuff like that, just because you're writing so much. With a blog, you know, obviously the style of writing is different because it's a lot looser. It's not as formal, particularly the style that I do. sometimes words are left out and stuff like that. With a book, you have to present it much more formally. But when you're writing every day for a blog and you're writing on, you know, very tight deadlines, if something happens, you want to get something up very quickly, you know, sometimes within half an hour, sometimes even less. All that writing is good for you. Any sort of writing, any sort of constant writing is good for you, and it gets you better and it gets you more sort of in tune with the instrument that you're using. And once you transition to a book, it's almost sort of a breath of fresh air. There's no deadline for a book. You can take your time. You can make sure everything's worded correctly. But you still have that ability to write a lot. So, like, for example, if I said, okay, I have to write 1,000 or 2,000 of words of this book today. It's not as daunting of a task when you know that you're doing it usually for a blog every day in little sort of increments. The other thing about the book is that, you know, since the book is written in this sort of blog format, that helped me with the transition. And I think that was a bit dangerous for me, obviously, because then it's a bit transparent. It's okay, oh, he's a blogger, so it's in blogger form, so he made it easier for himself, which is absolutely true. It's totally true. Right. I mean, but it ended up also being the right choice for having to tell the story, but it was an easy entry point for me into learning how to write a novel essentially by writing it.
Because blogs do have there's a narrative arc from posting to posting, but over the course of, you know, the blogosphere or even within one particular one, they do tend to kind of atomize themselves. The idea doesn't hold together as well as it must in a novel.
Yes, that's right. And the other thing is that blogging and the internet, it's changing the way we read. I don't know about you, I mean, but when it comes to me, I tend to have a shorter attention span when I'm reading online. I'll read a bit of it. If there's a long form article, I read a bit of it, then go check out the news, then I'll go back to it, then I might check out some other article. And so everything is done piecemeal. And I think that one of the reasons that people, you know, that have read the blog have enjoyed the novel is because it reads very much the same way that you would read on the internet. It's that very quick, short snippets, And we sort of transition as fast as we can into different things without losing sense of the narrative flow in the center.
Now, you wrote a book before this called Men with Balls, The Professional Athlete's
That
Handbook.
I did.
And it is this is certainly a departure from that.
Yes, it is.
And from your sports kind of blogging.
It
now,
is.
I mean, are you worried your fans are going to sort of lose you in this? You've...
No. I mean, it's at a certain point, it's weird, but sports tends to be the last real literary ghetto. Where if you write in sports, people who don't like sports almost certainly aren't going to read it, unless it's something like Seabiscuit or something like that. Chances are, if you write a sports book, it's only going to be a certain amount of sports fans that are going to read it. And even they are going to have a hard, you're going to have a hard time convincing them, because a sports book isn't as cool as watching just plain old sports. You know, sports movies and sports books have the opposite effect of on TV, where, you know, if you see a movie that's based on a book, you always say the book is better. But if you read a book based on a game you watched, the game's always better.
It's
always better. Yeah. So this is, you know, you have to be able to break out. And if I wanted to stay, you know, sort of viable as a writer, I knew that I had to do something different. Not some sort of grand statement. It didn't have to be serious. It didn't have to be something, you know, that was like, here's my announcement as a serious writer. It just had to be different. It had to be something that people who had never heard of Deadspin or KSK would read.
Let's talk a little bit about those blogs.
Sure.
For those in our audience who may not have heard about Deadspin or Kissing
a lot of them.
Covert, very possible. But these are kind of reports on sports, and they take a look at sports reporting as well. ESPN often in the crosshairs. Give us a theory behind this, and kind of what's the zeitgeist? What is the purpose of these blogs?
Well, to me, you know, Deadspin started as basically an antipode to ESPN, where ESPN has been such a dominant voice in sports for so long and went unchallenged for so long that it was important in 2005, 2006, when Will Leach founded the site, that there be another voice, and that there be a voice that say, hey, listen, you don't have to accept ESPN's worldview of sports all the time, and you don't have to be the sort of sports fan that ESPN is always commanding you to be, because ESPN is serving a very specific kind of sports fan, usually stupid, usually someone who thinks they know better than coaches and GMs and fancies themselves, you know, the smartest trivia sports expert in the bar. And not all sports fans are like that. Not all sports fans should be like that. And what Deadspin gave a lot of sports fans the freedom to do was to say, okay, well, we don't really know anything. We don't really know anything, and we're much more interested, you know, not only in sports, but in, you know, making fun of athletes and wondering, you know, if the athletes go out and get, you know, blotto at the bar, you know, 5 minutes after the game, and would like to see a picture of them getting drunk at the bar 5 minutes after the game, if possible. So it was set up to serve all the needs of sports fans that ESPN didn't cover.
In some ways, though, that belies the characterization of the sports fan. I think we all know who you're talking about. And, yeah, ESPN has built an industry around catering to that fan. But it belies what you said earlier about the game being better than the book. The fact is, sports fans do love to talk endlessly about that bad decision to go for the field goal instead of the touchdown, or the touchdown instead of the field goal. We'll talk about that 30 years after the coach is dead.
Oh, sure. But one of the nice things is when you can say it almost with a wink, like, you know, you're mad about it, but yet you also know in the back of your mind, well, you know, if I had been coaching the team, we would have been lost. We would have lost 70-0. So,
right. Or the endless comparisons. You know, are the 2008 Jets as good as the, you know, 1920?
Oh, yeah.
It's like you can't even make that comparison, and yet you could argue about it until you die.
Yeah, and it's you want to recognize that you're filling time. You know, it's like, okay, I'm at a bar, I'm at a cocktail party, I'm talking to some other guy who I don't really know. How can we expend an hour and consume enough drinks as humanly possible so that, you know, we can tolerate this situation? And usually it's, you know, who's better, Eli Manning or Peyton Manning? You know, there are easy ways to – it's an easy way to slide into male camaraderie.
Just to have a fight. It's been a tumultuous time, really, in the sports world. You've got the scandal involving Joe Paterno in the Nittany Lions. Then his death, of course. Coverage of football scandals, the NFL lockout. Is sports becoming just not fun anymore, too corrupt?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's always been corrupt in a sense. I mean, you know, you go back to 1919 with the Black Sox. There's always been that element of sleaziness and dirtiness and that sort of seamy underbelly. That's true in all aspects of life. It's no different in sports. And, you know, the truth is that I think some of those things make sports more interesting. It wouldn't be fun if all the trains ran on time in sports. It's always fun to have villains and to have, things that, you know, sort of expand your worldview outside of just, okay, this is what happened in the game. No, I'm not saying, hey, that's great that what happened at Penn State happened. You know, don't quote me on that. But when bad things happen in sports like that, there is a certain depth. There is a certain way of thinking there are certain new ideas that you get when those things happen.
So here's another thought experiment for you.
Sure.
If you take the premise of the post-mortal that we can arrest our aging, would sports be interesting to us at all? To what extent does our imminent aging and decrepitude make watching sports all the more powerful for us?
Well, I think one thing it would do is it would get rid of, the sort of the sad athlete archetype where it's, okay, his best days were when he was an athlete, and then for the next 50 years of his life, he's just fueled by memories. And that's sort of that sad gray ghost character that has become almost sort of indelible in American culture. What we would get instead, I think, would be something rather glorious where, your favorite athlete never retires. Your favorite athlete is always around. And in fact, your favorite athlete is going to have to compete for a roster spot every year because more and more gifted athletes get added to the mix, and they're not going to age either. So the natural progression of, X guy's job is taken by the guy who's 5 years younger. That all ends. So you'd have this big, glorious mess of talent, raw talent getting added every year, and you could expand leagues, and there could be 50 NFL teams, and they'd still all be stacked with great players, and then you'd have to worry, then you could argue about whether or not it's worse than steroid use because no one's aging. And
no
stuff
one's
like
aging. Year round football.
Yeah,
year round basketball.
People always will find a fun argument. People will always adapt and find a fun way to look at sports when things like that happen.
Drew, thanks for talking with us.
Sure, anytime, Frank.
Drew McGarry's debut novel is called The Postmortal. He'll be appearing at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7, the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tomorrow at 7, and you can catch his writing on Deadspin.com and KissingSusieKobler.com. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.